Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
I raced down the stairs to the phone and grabbed the receiver, only to find myself immediately surprised by a slow, intense voice. "Have you got a photocopier?" It was 1990. I was 24 years old and still living at home with my parents. Why on earth would I own a photocopier? And then it dawned on me. The man on the phone asking me this odd question must be the poet Paul Durkin. I was to make copies of my poems and be at Trinity College the following week. He was writer in residence there and he'd accepted me onto his course. Unlike today, poetry workshops in Dublin at the start of the 90s were rare, and I was thrilled by the invitation. This was the poet, after all, who had written The Berlin Wall Café. I'd instantly loved poems like The Haulier's Wife Meets Jesus on the Road Near Moon or The Cabinet Table. And his poems about the end of his marriage were so heartbreaking that they seemed to hurt my fingers when I first traced the words on the page. "The Pieta's over. It is Easter over all our lives. The revelation of our broken marriage and its resurrection." Back then, I'd also seen Paul Durkin perform his poems. He was truly the first performance poet I'd ever witnessed, clad in vibrant shirts, swaying back and forth, eyes closed, his low voice hushing the theatre. It was impossible not to fall under his poetry's spell. What happened in those poetry workshops in Trinity in 1990? Paul Durkin was enthusiastic about us all being there, a small group of poets starting out on our creative journeys. We read our poems to him, and he gave encouraging responses. He listened attentively, and often with an air of curiosity, scribbled down the things we said about poetry. He also told us he was in the throes of finishing a new book. It was to be called Daddy, Daddy. One evening, Paul held up a small postcard of a painting by the Finnish symbolist artist Hugo Sinberg. He wanted to use it for the cover of his book. What did we think of it? A young angel, head bandaged and wing bloodied, is being carried on a stretcher by two boys. The painting is bleak, painful, but the snowdrops the angel clutches offer a sense of hope and healing. I found it completely absorbing, saw in her wounded state a deep devastation which I felt again when I read Durkin's new collection published later that year. Striking, surreal poems, most compellingly about his troubled relationship with his father. "Daddy, Daddy, oh wounded angel, when will you deploy your wings?" Paul also spoke to us about poets he knew, particularly Michael Hartnett, whom he revered and first met in 1962 when they both enrolled in UCD together, in those days located in Earlsford Terrace. The two students often strolling through Stephen's Green or through the Ivy Gardens, young men dreaming of poetry. How could I ever forget the story of himself and Hartnett presenting themselves at the headquarters of Securicorps in 1960s London, only to both be hired, two young Irish poets in uniforms and peaked hats being dispatched to guard a financial institution and an air transport terminal in London, a tale worthy of a Paul Durkin poem for sure. "This head is a poet's head. This head holds a galaxy," Michael Hartnett once wrote, and we were convinced that Paul Durkin's head also held just that, a marvellous galaxy that lit up our writing firmament. On the last night of the workshops, we all invited Paul to the Lincoln Inn, around the corner from Trinity. There, in the dark back corner, we sipped on Guinness, he on a mug of tea, our heads leaning in to hear more stories, such as the one he told us about a life-changing summer day when he was in his 20s. It was 1967, and the young Durkin had befriended the poet Patrick Kavanagh. The older poet was to die in November of that year, but on August the 1st, he invited Paul to come with him to a wedding in the Shangri-La Hotel, perched high over Bullock Harbour in Dalkey. When the two poets arrived, the doorman refused them entry, thinking the pair of them looked too down at heel. Nevertheless, they managed to get in, and it was there, Durkin told us, that he met his future wife, a beautiful red-haired young woman. She asked him, did he want to go for a swim? And that was a whirlpool. That was a whirlpool, and I very nearly drowned. This week, Paul Durkin, the finest of poets, turned 80. I think back now to the young woman I was, racing down the stairs of my childhood home decades ago, poetry in my head and heart, bursting to write, only to pick up the receiver and to be shown away, for a few weeks at least, by the poet on the other end who asked me with all sincerity, "Have you got a photocopier?"
I met her on the 1st of August in the Shangri-La Hotel. She took me by the index finger and dropped me in her well. And that was a whirlpool. That was a whirlpool. And I very nearly drowned. "Take off your pants," she said to me, and I very nearly didn't. "Would you care to swim?" she said to me, and I hopped into the Irish Sea, and that was a whirlpool. That was a whirlpool, and I very nearly drowned. On the way back, I fell in the field, and she fell down beside me. I'd have lain in the grass with her all my life. But Nessa, she was a whirlpool. She was a whirlpool, and I very nearly drowned. Nessa, my dear, will you stay with me on the rocks? Will you come for me into the Irish Sea? And for me, let your red hair down. And then we will ride into Dublin City in a taxi cab wrapped up in dust. Oh, you are a whirlpool. You are a whirlpool. And I am very nearly drowned.
What sticks in your mind from the things you learned in school? There are the effects of glaciation on a V-shaped valley. There are the Gotobans and the Nos na Gaoithes, the bricks and mortar of an Irish essay. Or from biology, those cell clusters known as the islets of Langerhans. We love that in Cork. But as Maths Week draws to a close, how many of your school memories are from maths? Multiply down by the power, reduce the power by one, always start on the left-hand side, bomb das, brackets of, multiply, divide, addition, subtraction. We don't seem to remember maths unless it's traumatic. There are no oxbow lakes to soothe the soul. But behind the theorems and equations, there are stories in maths. Stories we never learned. Well, I didn't anyway. We proved Pythagoras was right for the squillionth time in right-angled triangles, but we didn't hear that he had his own cult, which worshipped the perfection of numbers. In fact, the story goes that the perfection of numbers was so important to these ancient Greeks that they murdered one of their brethren, who found a number that was irrational. Hippasus found out that the square root of 2 couldn't be written as a fraction and was, according to legend, tossed overboard during a sea voyage. Imagine that, covering up a number. I studied calculus for 3 years, but it wasn't until about 3 weeks before the Leaving Cert that I was told it was used by forensic scientists to figure out how long a body had been dead for. And even more interestingly, calculus has a role to play in figuring out when to put milk in your tea if someone calls to the door just at the moment you've made it. Answer straight away. Symmetry, yeah, it was dull. Circles are symmetrical. My big lumpy Irish head is not. But what if I told you that eventually symmetry turns into a fierce, interesting area of maths called tessellation or tiling, and was once the reason for a toilet roll mathematics lawsuit? Sorry, what? Yes, a mathematician called Roger Penrose invented and patented a tiling pattern that was non-repeating. Kleenex then used this Penrose tiling pattern in the embossing of a toilet roll. The problem with embossed toilet roll, as you all know, is that the roll can be hard to unroll, as the embossings have sort of stuck into each other. But not if it's a non-repeating pattern. So they used Penrose tiling. He sued, they stopped. Teenagers, are you prone to dramatic gestures and also wondering about the point of those algebraic expressions known as polynomials? Well, look no further than your buddy, 19th century mathematician Évariste Galois, who managed to be an expert at polynomials and the most dramatic Frenchman ever. A hothead revolutionary, he died in a duel over a woman, and the night before he wrote down all the maths he knew in the form of a series of letters that he sent to others. Now that's what I call main character energy. And maths is absolutely everywhere. Take biology. If we can tear ourselves away from the islets of Langerhans for a second, just take a few minutes to look at how the seeds on the head of a sunflower seem to spiral out from the centre and then count them. If that doesn't sound like fun, call it mindfulness. You will notice when you count that they seem to follow the Fibonacci sequence, in which each number is the sum of the two preceding ones. In the words of Tom Hanks in the Da Vinci Code film, "I need to get to a library, fast." And then, to bring us back down to earth, don't worry about picking the right job. Your career will surely never be as futile as that of Ludolf van Coulen, a 16th century Dutch mathematician who dedicated decades of his life to calculating pi, but in an old-fashioned way, to 35 decimals. Not long after him, however, along came Isaac Newton and Gottfried Leibniz, armed with their new techniques in calculus, who just left him in their dust. It's as if he was working on a huge improvement to the horse and carriage just as the car came in. I'm under no illusions that throwing a few stories into the maths stew is going to lead to teenage epiphanies and dance-offs and a 43% reduction in Leaving Cert nightmares, but I'd love if there was space in maths class for a few more stories and yarns and a bit of gossip. Not because it's coming up on the exam or useful for a job, but because we might remember it. Maybe some sweltering May night when grinding your way through past papers, trying to figure out the F of X, you'd remember one story about how our entire existence depends on a number equal to roughly 1 over 137, known as the fine structure constant, or how, topologically speaking, a human is the same as a donut, and that a Pringle is the same shape as the space-time continuum. And that maths, for all its forbidding reputation, is just as full of mad yokes and dreamers and cranks and misfits and flawed human beings as the rest of us, and all of them ripe for a good old gossip.
is a magic number. Yes, it is. It's a magic number. Somewhere in the ancient mystic trinity, you get three.
My name is Thirrin, once an unusual name in Ireland. I was well into adulthood before I heard of anyone with the same name. In a Barcelona bookshop in the late 70s, my eye fell on a book whose author's name startled me. Her first name was Thirrin. Until then, every time I'd seen the name written, it had referred to me, and me only. So it was a shock to find there was an academic at the University of Barcelona bearing the name Thirrin MacDermott. I recently found out that she was born in 1923 and was given the name by her Irish father, who was in the British Navy. I don't think she ever lived in Ireland, brought up as she was in Austria and the Isle of Wight. But she became a renowned philologist, and there's an annual Thirrin MacDermott lecture in Barcelona. As to how I came to be called Thirrin, my father had found the name in an old book of Irish names, liked the sound of it, and bestowed it on me with great pleasure. It appears in more than one poem in Irish written in the 17th century, so it has been used as a woman's name for hundreds of years. As an Irish-speaking family, we knew how to pronounce it, but others didn't, so I got used to having to spell it and explain it and deal with the regular and annoying question, "What's that in English?" "It's an Irish name," I would growl. "There's no translation." Eventually, I ended up being quite proud of my unique name, so I was amazed to discover recently that it's now quite common, and that 168 babies in Ireland were given the name in 2023. As I searched on the CSO website for that fascinating piece of information, I discovered just how popular Irish names have become in recent years. Mind you, there are Irish names now that were never names before, that is, words that were never used as proper names as they are now. Aisling, for example, was not historically a name for a girl, but rather a form of poetry, as my father firmly pointed out to me when my husband and I suggested we might call one of our daughters by that name. We called her Gráinne instead. On the CSO website, all the baby names registered in Ireland since 1964 are recorded and analysed. There are no statistics for the year of my birth, but by 1975 there were four Thirrins. The following year there were six, and it climbed slowly every year after that. By 1980 there were nine, and then suddenly in 1981 there were 16. I think I can explain the appearance of the name in 1975 and the spike in 1981. I worked as a TV presenter in the early 1970s and was a regular face in single-channel land by 1975 when the four Thirrins appeared. In 1981, I presented the Eurovision Song Contest, and that year 16 were registered with the name. And up it crawled from then on, reaching its apogee last year. I've no doubt that TV and radio presenter Thirrin Garrahy has a lot to do with that, as well as the poet Thirrin Ní Gréifhe and musician Thirrin Ní Chlocáin. But Thirrin is still in the halfpenny place compared to Fia. 300 babies were given that name last year. When I was a child, a Fia was a deer, but like Aisling, it has become a popular and a lovely given name now, as has my own granddaughter's name, Eve, spelt A-O-I-B-H, one of whose meanings is smile. Which brings me to the thorny matter of how to pronounce any name with the letters A-O-I in it. Aoife, for example. Saoirse. Caoimhe. Naoise. The A-O-I sound in Irish is pronounced like a double E in English, and people have got used to that. So what's happened to Eivin and Ivan, two names which begin with exactly the same letters and should sound the same, but now appear to be commonly pronounced Eivin, making it even harder to make the link between the written name and the spoken one? Indeed, one of our new naval vessels has been called what Irish speakers would pronounce as Eiving, but I've already heard it pronounced Eivin. When it comes to boys' names, the most common Irish language boys' name last year was Rian. Again, never a given name in my day. It's nice, though, and easy to pronounce. And there were 339 of them in 2023. As for meanings, there's a plethora of websites which have invented the most bizarre origins and explanations for Irish names, old and new. They have a habit of claiming that some of the new names are ancient Gaelic. One of them says the name Sean means God is gracious. Bizarrely, it says Siobhan means the same thing. As a child of the 1950s, when Irish names were going out of fashion, while I may be a bit cranky about how they're sometimes pronounced, I'm delighted to see them back in vogue.
After the evening news, we got into the car and made our way up the hill, fleeing the lights of Kenmare town. I was still in my slippers, my husband John in his tartan pyjama bottoms, both wrapped in our large coats grabbed from the hallway rack. Passing the ruins of a soup kitchen, a fever hospital, and a former smoked salmon factory, the bungalows thinning out, we drove until all that was illuminated by the car lights were low scrub ditches and ink-black areas of forestry. God willing, we'd see it. We'd stay until 10:30 and hope to witness this indomitable poem as described by poet Nuala Ní Gonail. Aurora Borealis, the mellow and melodious lamentation of the globe, rounding on its axis. On top of the hill, John pulled the car into the forest opening, close to the isolated old Kenmare Road, and turned off the engine. Outside, we waited for the car's front beams to switch off, realising how cold the autumn evenings had become. As before, it would take a little time for our eyes to adjust. We'd come up here on other clear nights to observe the great span of the Milky Way, undamaged by light pollution. The prominent constellations were soon visible, the Hunter, the Plough, and the North Star, and then the vast swathe of the Milky Way, like endless diamonds scattered across black felt. It was majestic, but I thought about photographs taken by friends who'd witnessed the Northern Lights earlier this year, in Kerry, Donegal and Roscommon. I'd woken up to Instagram posts of green and red night skies, and I felt I'd missed something that might never return in my lifetime. Yet after some time gazing, both John and I spotted light dispersing from one area of the horizon, though sunset was long over. I pointed my compass towards it and the brightness was due north. Compared to the southwest, where the crescent moon was crisp on blackness, the northern sky was less translucent, like it had the faintest wash of white gouache paint curving across a third of it. To the northeast, in this aura, a hint of red rose out of the shadow, organic, like paint bleeding out of a brush when it touched water. Then, a few moments later, a faint line rose from the horizon, like a weak torchlight, and to the left, moving east, the first hints of wavish green. Over the period of 30 minutes, the whitish aura took on ever-changing, though subtle shades of green and red, like the washes of watercolour on slate grey, as if there was a giant in the sky tracing green and red sand in swirls with a delicate finger. Our phones, with their long lens exposures, could capture the colours with more intensity than our naked eyes. I sent pictures to friends, urging them to go outside. A couple of cars appeared on the road and pulled into the lay-by beside our own. We recognised voices. You're here for the same thing, along with excited laughs. There was a child allowed out after bedtime, with a parent saying, "I'll tell your teacher you'll be okay." And I thought of how lucky this child was to see something so ephemeral that most people never see it in their lifetime. Why are we so fascinated by the Northern Lights? Perhaps it is to do with their rarity and their delicacy. witnessing the aurora borealis is a chance to be close to the celestial, to be immersed in something akin to a supernova. As I watched the shifting colours, Lacrimosa, a song from the Tree of Life soundtrack by Terrence Malick, rose into my mind, and I recalled the film's montages of the birth of the universe. What struck me about the silent and sublime beauty of the aurora borealis was how the same physical forces that governed it, some thousands of miles away, were causing the monstrous Hurricane Milton to ravage Florida, and how nature can be understood with maths and science, but never completely understood by the heart. Yet we've never stopped trying. The Northern Lights are a sight that's inspired artists for tens of thousands of years, going back to cave paintings in southern France, all the way to recent times, notably in Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials trilogy. Yet perhaps it's a phenomenon best understood by poetry, because the Northern Lights do constitute an indomitable poem, as Nuala Nagonal describes. She also calls them a lucent prayer, and as I stood on the roadside in the dark, watching colour behave as if it was music, though I rarely pray with words, it felt like there was a sort of prayer all around me.
When I was a child, my father was always building bookcases. They lined the walls of each room, except the kitchen, and eventually colonised the upstairs landing, already made almost impassable by a vast mahogany wardrobe and a heavy chest of drawers, both of which also contained books. He and my mother, who'd married with very little money in the 1940s, had set up house with hand-me-downs and ingenuity. Their first home featured a piece of furniture my father made from an old tea chest, disguised with a padded cushion and a length of orange fabric held in place with copper-headed tacks. In 1953, it travelled on to the house where I was born. There, emitting strong pre-IKEA vibes, it functioned both as a seat and as a handy storage unit for books that wouldn't squeeze into the landing wardrobe, or onto the new shelves my father constructed, which he fitted with cardboard backs painted eggshell blue. The books I grew up with were largely hand-me-downs too, well-thumbed by my four elder siblings or picked up from second-hand bookshops and stalls. Twice a year, though, for Christmas and my birthday, I'd receive cards from my godfather with a book token tucked inside, bringing the promise of new, sharp-edged dust jackets yet to become dog-eared, and a visit to Parsons' bookshop on Baggot Street Bridge. Parsons was a Dublin institution, small, crowded, and run by formidable women. It was famously the haunt of writers like Brendan Behan and Patrick Kavanagh, figures I knew only as large adults getting between me and the books on the shelves. I remember wriggling past one or other of them to take down a paperback copy of Mary Renault's The King Must Die, a historical novel which reworks the early life of the mythological hero Theseus of Athens. I remember the smell of paper and print, and the slight resistance from the unbroken spine when I opened it. The cover design of the Four Square Books edition had striking typography, and an image suggestive of a frieze from Knossos, which, in 1960s Ireland, felt sophisticated as well as dramatic. Looking back, I can see The King Must Die contains themes that occasionally crop up in my own novels, such as intersections between folklore, history, myth and matriarchy. I was raised on the Táin Bó Cúaillne and folktales told by my granny, so I imagine I chose that book largely because of its blurb. But though at the time I just read it as a page-turner, Renaud's storytelling subtly challenged 1960s assumptions, from cultural colonialism to LGBT sexuality, and opened a window or two that post-war isolationism in Ireland had slammed shut. Aged 16, in Kenny's bookshop in Galway, my birthday book token bought me The Penguin Book of Irish Verse, edited by the poet Brendan Kennelly. It came home to join scuffed green penguin Niall Marsh's, various Agatha Christie's, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, and earlier treasures like Patricia Lynch's The Turfcutter's Donkey, illustrated by Jack B. Yeats and picked up on a pavement stall outside Fred Hanna's, and her Bookshop on the Quay, illustrated by Peggy Fortnum, and found for me by my father, very appropriately, in a bookshop on the quays. My birthday poetry anthology took its place on our cardboard-backed bookshelves in an ever-expanding collection, alongside biographies, histories and horror stories, Woodhouse, Green, Tolstoy, Peg and Shakespeare, on Tathair Padraig Ó Laoghaire, and several Collins Little Gem dictionaries and Methuen editions of Noel Coward plays. It occurs to me now that all that paper and cloth and leather binding must also have functioned as insulation, much as the turf stack at one gable end and the midden at the other kept my great-grandparents' generation warm in their whitewashed cottages on the west coast or in rural Wexford. If it did, it was needed. In those days, Dublin suburban houses weren't centrally heated, at least ours wasn't. The kitchen was warmed by a coke stove and the heat produced by my mother cooking for seven. But the rest of the house could be arctic, so much of our family life was spent around a cold fire in the dining room, where for most of the year the table was used by my father as a desk. On it, he wrote history books and articles for newspapers and scripts for RTE television and radio plays and pageants that were performed at Slane and on the Hill of Tara, with regiments of the Irish army thundering round on horses, being invading Vikings or the forces of Brian Boru. But for Christmas and birthdays, his work was swept away to reveal the table's well-worn surface. China would emerge from the press, where it was kept for special occasions, and tea would be eaten in state, with scones and cake and sometimes trifle. If the birthday was mine, the conversation would always centre on how and where to spend my book token. And looking back now in my 70th year, it seems to me that those tokens were the best gifts I've ever received.
Last evening I turned back the pages of time and tore out the chapters when you were mine.
On his sixth birthday, October the 16th, 1950, his mother took him to see his first film. If she had promised him only a bus ride into the city centre, he would have been frantic with expectation. But not only did she take him on a bus ride into the city centre, the number 11 into Nelson's Pillar, just she and he alone in the front seat together on the upstairs deck, but on disembarking in O'Connell Street, she took him by the hand and steered him up the steps of the Metropole Cinema. This new, until now forbidden, world of cinema was a second extension of his mother's bedroom, the first extension being the parish chapel. The red carpets, the gilded mirrors, the brass stair rods, the swing doors within swing doors, veil upon veil of a temple, proceeding to the inner sanctum, the plush, tip-up seats, the hush when the lights dimmed, the girl acolyte strapped to her tray of tubs of ice cream and beakers with straws, floor-to-ceiling wine-red curtains being parted to reveal the forbidden silver screen, and he, seated beside his mother in the public dark, safe in the abyss, gazing up at the soft black rain of her hair, her mouth glistening with plum-red lipstick, her white pearl necklace, her white pearl earrings. What could be more vista-rich for a six-year-old boy than to be seated in cinema darkness at his first film with his young mother, his first sweetheart? Larger-than-life pictures on the screen filled him with freedom, longing, dread. When horses appeared on the crest of a hill, galloping cross-country to the port of Bristol, he ducked his head in his seat for fear of being trampled to death by their onrushing hooves. Long John Silver made a grand entrance as the buccaneer to beat all buccaneers, parrot on shoulder, with a glass of rum and a gleaming eye, and his unshaven, bristling black chin, and his one leg, and his West Country piratical voice, and a small boy on his sixth birthday gripped tight his mother's hand. The first film of his life she had chosen to bring him to was Treasure Island, starring Robert Newton as Long John Silver, Dennis O'Dea as Dr. Livesey, and Spike Milligan as Ben Gunn. In his cinema seat, he became Jim Hawkins, sitting in secret at the bottom of the barrel, overhearing things a boy should never overhear. For the first time, he understood that the price of knowledge is death. When they emerged out of the film as out of a book of the Old Testament, day had changed into night and it was raining. All of Dublin was black water and city lights, and his mother queued for a number 11 bus. They sailed home aboard the Hispaniola to the coal fire and the brass tongs by which they lolled until he fell asleep. As surely as God created heaven and earth, henceforth, aged 6 years, his life in all its people and all its places would be a treasure island, a tropic idyll forever under threat, a geography revealed to him by his mother, sweet Sheila McBride, who had married John Durkin, one of the black, red, roaring, fighting Durkins of Mayo.
On this morning's programme, you heard Have You Got a Photocopier? In Praise of Paul Durkin on His 80th Birthday by Enda Wiley. Nessa, a poem by Paul Durkin from the Irish Writers Centre's CD Dublin 15, Poems of the City. By My Calculations was by Colm O'Regan. My Name by Dhiruni Vrien. Indomitable Poem was by Jamie O'Connell. Books by Felicity Hayes McCoy. And from the RTE Radio Archive, Treasure Island, another poem by Paul Durkin. The music was Telephone and Rubber Band by the Penguin Cafe Orchestra, Sea of Love, played on guitar by John Fahey, Three is a Magic Number, sung by Elizabeth Mitchell, Dhiren's Waltz by Mick McCauley and Colm O'Keefe, Lacrimosa by Zbigniew Preisner, and Pages by Willie Nelson. Felicity Hayes McCoy's latest novel, The Bookseller's Gift, is just out from Hachette and she is an ambassador for Irish Book Week. And 80 at 80, a selection of poems by Paul Durkin, edited by Manoil McMonagall, has just been published by Harville Secker. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.